Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Bubble. He is Mike Bonner. I am Montana Samuels, and we are back for our second pod of our trilogy podcast about InfoWars and how it's interacting with social media. And we figured we'd just jump right into it this time around.
One quick thing. If you hear seagulls in this podcast, it's because our window is open because the Standard Times doesn't have air conditioning.
It's hot, so we open the window. But anyway, let's get into it.
We'll get at it here with Professor Dwight Duncan from UMass Dartmouth here to talk about what we've been talking about last week and what we'll continue to do next week in our three-part series. But Professor Duncan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah.
Glad to be with you.
Great. So I guess the big question and kind of the overlapping umbrella type question that includes it all is, how does the First Amendment, from your perspective, play into this InfoWars social media story?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, partly because, you know, the First Amendment, like pretty much all the Bill of Rights, applies to government action, what we call state action. So it's really a restriction on governmental infringement of free speech and of the press, right? So my sense of it is that the InfoWars, you know, we're talking about really big private corporations, right? Mm-hmm. That may be subject to regulation, but in principle, you know, freedom of speech runs, you know, in favor of the private entity, right, against the government. So, I mean, I think that's kind of the overarching constitutional question, you know, here. Are we talking about public governmental speech or are we talking about private speech? Mm-hmm. And if it's private speech, then it's protected by the First Amendment.
Right. And it seems like here my understanding and kind of looking and reading some of it, it was more with business speech, and so to speak, because in order to, you know, speak on Twitter or Facebook or mm-hmm. whatever it may be, you have to agree to certain rules that they are allowed to kind of censor that speech. Is that correct in saying that if I'm using whatever avenue, whether it's MySpace mm-hmm. or Facebook or whatever it may be that is existing or no longer existing, that you have to kind of abide by those rules and companies can't do that?
Yes, I think that's right. You know, in traditional media, mm-hmm. right, there was a pretty sharp distinction between, you know, communications media between common carriers mm-hmm. on the one hand, which essentially were required to carry everybody's stuff, like, for example, the phone lines, right? Okay. You can basically say whatever you want over the phone, I mean, you know, with some broad limits in terms of threatening speech or whatever, mm-hmm. or annoying and harassing speech. But basically, the idea is the phone company really doesn't get involved.
That's,
you know, and censoring people's private communications, right? But then there was, you know, another category of communication, which was basically broadcast, you know, television, radio. And as to that, you know, there was a kind of broad government regulation in the public interest, right? Whatever, you know, in terms of what was allowed to be broadcast. And so, you know, licensees, whether radio or television, had to somehow operate in the public interest or show that, you know, that they were being responsible in terms of their use of the broadcast spectrum. So in that sense, there was more government regulation that was permissible of the content of broadcast speech. Of course, internet falls sort of between the two, the two extremes, you know, of common carrier to private, you know, phone line kind of thing, and the broadcast, right? And so to a certain degree, I think the legal system is really only now, you know, kind of catching up with the technological developments, right? So there are very significant issues obviously raised by corporate power and, you know, the ability that these large entities like Google or Facebook or what have you have to essentially, you know, control speech, right? And, you know, in principle, the First Amendment protects them in that, although I think it may, in fact, be more complicated, you know,
right,
in practice.
Well, and so that sort of gets a, I was, when this story first came up, I was really curious to see even your opinion on how, like you said, the government and how they're legislating this is sort of just catching up to the internet. What do you think, if you're willing to hypothesize, what the future of, like, how the First Amendment may interact with these, like, terms of service agreements that these internet companies have? Do you think there will be more government interaction into ensuring that people have a platform to continue to speak, or do you think they'll allow them the right to censor when they deem fit?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I'm not, you know, I wish I were in a better position to answer intelligently. I guess my sense of it is that, you know, we're in a very evolving kind of framework now.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are certain extremes. Like, I don't think government should be basically, government should assume the role of censor, right?
Sure.
And more or less decide what's allowed and what isn't allowed on social media. But that being said, I think government could have a role in sort of policing fair access, right, to social media, and that there not be, you know, kind of discriminatory practices on the part of social media providers, right? Facebook or Google or YouTube or what have you. So I mean, it just seems to me like, and I'm not really sure how this is eventually going to fall out, right? But I do think the First Amendment is going to prevent a situation where government makes these calls, right, all the time.
Sure.
Although I think there is a role for government in assuring sort of equal access in a way to the internet.
You mentioned earlier about, you know, telephone service and then broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how long it took after the invention of those items for the laws to kind of settle into place? Whereas social media, as you said, it's relatively new. It's been around about a decade-ish. And especially the way it's been using now, I feel like YouTube 5 years ago was about funny cat videos, and now it's very much changed.
Sure.
Is there a sense of how long the laws may need to catch up in terms of a time span?
My sense of it is it probably is, you know, is going to take another decade, I think, you know, to kind of settle down. In the case of the broadcast media, it started with federal regulation of the radio in the 1920s. And then, you know, with the invention of television in the 1930s, it expanded to that. But it took a while for legal doctrines to develop. I mean, there was the development of a doctrine called the Fairness Doctrine, right, that assured that broadcasters essentially give equal time to, varying views on controversial issues of public importance, or give equal time to coverage of major candidates, right, this kind of thing. But it's interesting that kind of the Fairness Doctrine was itself repealed in the early 1980s under the Reagan administration, because there was a feeling that somehow the private market should really resolve these questions, and that there was no longer the kind of a scarcity of spectrum, you know, broadcast spectrum space with the advent of cable and satellite and, you know, all the kinds of, and the internet, you know, there was no longer need for government to kind of get into these content kind of issues, right?
Right.
So I thought that was an interesting development. And I do think, just in general, our system tends to favor, you know, the private entities, right, the private parties, vis-a-vis the government, right, when it comes to expressive questions.
Right. When you were, I'm just curious about sort of your broad overview of the happenings within the InfoWars Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, as the story is played out. Was there anything that jumped out to you from a First Amendment perspective that seemed odd or strange or seemed like there was something that could have broader implications moving forward from that story?
Well, it's a good question, but I honestly haven't followed it, the InfoWars, all that closely, so I have to punt there, I think.
Sure.
Something that's kind of come up when I'm reading about it and thinking about it a lot was people's interpretation of the First Amendment and free speech. We don't talk about it a lot, and this is how my mind kind of worked in the First Amendment and Second Amendment, and it's very quite commonplace that there are restrictions on the Second Amendment in whether you call it gun control or now.
Right.
What kind of restrictions, or if any, are there on the First Amendment regarding speech, or, you know, using the same term, speech control? What are some of the regulations there?
Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, in fact, there's very little control over the content of by government over the content of speech, but there is a fair amount of control over what's called the time, place, and manner of speech. Right. So I don't know. You could restrict having a loudspeaker, you know, in a neighborhood, right?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you couldn't restrict, you know, people from talking about certain subjects on the public sidewalk, right?
Mm-hmm.
So content-based restrictions are always much more problematic, you know, apart from a very narrow category of speech that is, for example, incitement to, you know, imminent violence, right? Or obscenity, you know, which is fairly restrictively defined, right? Those forms of expression fall outside First Amendment protection. But in general, you know, the government can regulate the time, place, or manner of speech, right? So, you know, where and how the speech is maintained, you know, can vary quite considerably in the legal system. The thing that I've noticed in the past few years, and I'm noticing it among my students, and that is my sense is that the millennials and, you know, and younger, they kind of don't instinctively get the First Amendment. In other words, they, you know, I think my generation was sort of, which was the 60s, was sort of schooled in the First Amendment in a way, right, that all the social protests of the 60s, both the civil rights and the Vietnam War protests, really depended on, you know, a wide understanding of freedom of speech and of the press, right? And what I'm seeing now is, because of political correctness, because of a reaction to Trump, whatever it is, there's much less appreciation for the significance and value and importance of the First Amendment, right? I mean, even the fact that Trump so cavalierly criticizes the, you know, the press with his tweets, I think is a little bit of a sign of the times, right? That somehow he doesn't quite get freedom of the press. Mm-hmm. I don't think, right? That to have the president doing this is kind of unprecedented in a way. I mean, Nixon did it, but in private, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, whereas Trump does it publicly, and it's not just, you know, the Trump supporters that do this, the opponents of Trump do this, right? Mm-hmm. That they want to shut down people who disagree with them, right? So that they can't, they no longer have a speech platform, right?
Right. You sort of...
So I guess I'm a little, you know, I just am a little concerned about the future of the First Amendment, because up until now, our legal system has really prized the First Amendment, both freedom of speech, press, and also of religion. But increasingly, they are being called into question, right? So to me, that's a concern.
Do you think that has a lot to do with the fact that you mentioned the 60s era protests, and when those things were happening, it was obviously sort of pre-internet. You had to go out and protest, and that's where you were sharing your voice. And then inevitably, the interaction you would get would be with some sort of government entity, whether that be police or a politician responding or what have you. But for the younger generations, those conversations are happening via the internet or social media websites, and sort of like what we're talking about, the government hasn't quite chosen to interfere in those discussions yet, but we're now seeing the social media sites come in and sort of try to play referee to make those decisions. So do you think the understanding of the First Amendment differs at all based on the platform of the conversations that are being had, that are different generationally?
Well, yes, I do think there's a significant generational sort of shift in valuing the First Amendment, and I would just argue that these social media platforms like Instagram or Twitter or whatever, while they, I think it's fine that they police to a certain degree, you know, that the more extreme kind of racist or hateful or obscene kind of, conversations. I just would argue that they, that they value freedom of expression, as a very significant value, right?
Sure.
So that even if they're not technically bound by the First Amendment, nonetheless, the spirit of the First Amendment kind of animates their enterprise, right?
So, sure.
But, it's hard to comment intelligently without a sort of a specific proposal, in front of you.
Right.
And I guess I'll just kind of maybe wrap it up here in terms of it. You make a great point, and I'm trying to think through history. Is there anything like this where the means of using speech are so closely tied with a private industry, whether it be Facebook, Twitter, or whatever, where in the past it seemed like speech was directly, whether it was written or spoken, it was tied to that person, but now it seems like we're almost on the coattails of another industry. Is there anything like this? Is there any precedence of this in history that you can remember?
Well, I'm inclined to go back to something like the invention of the printing press, in the 1400s, right? That totally changed communication. I mean, things like the Protestant Reformation really, can only be understood, in terms of the availability of print in a way, So I'm thinking that really the internet is a very radical, media change, comparable to the inventing of the printing press, maybe. And so it's not surprising that there be these rather dramatic, fallout from it. And I think my sense of it is the culture and the law have to sort of come to terms with this or, figure out, how to get a handle on it, lest it could totally control us, I think.
Yeah, definitely questions to be watched in the future that really no one necessarily has. Professor Duncan, we really want to thank you so much. This was a really great conversation.
Oh, great. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
So once again, we just want to thank Professor Dwight Duncan from UMass Dartmouth for joining us and speaking through some of our hypotheticals with us. Just to give a brief update on where some of the players in this story that apparently is still developing stand. So the New York Times, they didn't take part in a discussion, but they were witness to a discussion of Twitter at Twitter headquarters involving CEO Jack Dorsey, Cecilia Kang or Kong, and Kate Conger. Wrote a story about it, and essentially this discussion was about their safety policies. How can Twitter, as a technological company, with their technology, police hate speech and conspiracy and different things of this nature. And Mike, do you want to guess what the answer to that question is?
They can't.
They don't know. They don't know. That's our update.
I think Professor Duncan brought up a really great point or great comparison that I had not thought of before. Is to me, Twitter is much more along the lines of the phone company than maybe some other social media aspects, in my opinion, because to me, Twitter is speech. That's all that it really is.
That's what makes Twitter
is its speech aspect.
Right.
Where Instagram is certainly more expression. Facebook is more community oriented, or the purpose of it. I don't know. I'm trying to, in my mind, think right now what other aspect, whether it's used properly or not. Like, for example, Facebook has its own problems, and but the key core of it is, you know, bringing community or friends together, and that's where it kind of started. Where to me, Twitter has always been.
It's where it developed, evolved to. It was definitely at first just meant to rate. It was very sexist in its origins, but we won't.
Facebook?
Yeah. You're up on. You saw The Social Network, didn't you?
I did not know.
I think it was originally created to rate women on a scale of 1 to 10.
Well, when I got it, I'm just saying.
Shout out to the Zuck.
I used it as a person in college trying to connect with friends.
Yeah.
Where
I just wanted to bring that up.
Now, for me, Twitter, it's always been about...
It's a soapbox, essentially.
Right. And for me, Facebook is the same thing. It's connecting with people. And I really don't even use Facebook that much anymore.
Right.
But Twitter, it's a soapbox. I think you said it perfectly.
So one thing that I really found interesting within this discussion, too, was how quickly legislation must evolve to sort of encompass the things that are happening with the internet. Right, so the internet is moving so fast that it's almost impossible for these legislative bodies to accurately create laws that sort of cover them properly. Because if you were to create, let's say right now, you were to create a law that made it so an Alex Jones network couldn't engage in conspiracy or misinformation anymore. There could be a workaround that happens tomorrow because it's the internet and we have people who are proficient at cheating internet systems that could completely negate the whole importance of that law. And so it's interesting to me to see Twitter sort of stepping out on this ledge as the only one who's like, well, let's have the conversation then. Whether or not it's working or it's not working or people are happy about it or not happy, they're still saying, well, is there anything that we can truly do about this rather than... And I don't know which is right, right? I don't know if they should just say we're banning Alex Jones because his content violated our terms of service. But, I mean, you look, Vimeo's the latest one. Vimeo, Facebook have all done it. Is having the conversation better than just banning it? Or are they actually doing a worse job? That's sort of the questions I'm trying to parse in my head as someone who's...
As you brought that up, I think it's an interesting point in the... evolution of humanity, or specifically the country, because you're 100% right. They're very complicated questions, and as we had Professor Duncan on, he wasn't much more well-versed. We're not sure of the answers yet, but I think it challenges the evolution of society because you need to have these conversations, and you can't have them in terms of DR win-loss.
Right.
It can't be, well, are you banning Alex Jones because you're a Democrat or a Republican? They need to just be had in logical conversation. And I'm not sure where we are as a country, especially the legislators,
to
try to figure that out. Because it's literally, it has to be a sit-down conversation.
Right. Well, the other interesting thing to add into that for context purposes is... financial bottom lines as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're not dealing with a government or even an independent person. We're dealing with businesses at the end of the day. Sure, they brand themselves as this sort of like community and like place of engagement and things like that. But if Jack Dorsey and Twitter start to, they see the company values start to go down exponentially because of this, I guarantee you there's a quick fix that happens. And Alex Jones will, like, if it's Alex Jones or anyone else related, that person who has instigated this loss of dollar figures will soon be taken care of on their platform.
Because, but I do think that's where laws come in differently, because it's not this... maybe it's kind of like the FDA, you know, because yes, you can produce food, but it has to be, has to, you know,
sure,
follow some of these guidelines. Social media is an entity in its own where it is like a food, you know, it can cause some huge damage if not properly manufactured correctly.
Well, we sort of,
and it's just like Professor Duncan said, you can't go out and you can't have a rally at midnight. The government can't impose that, saying, that can't do it.
Sure.
So there is some things that can be, now the content is certainly something that, how do you get around that? But there are some ways, as I think I made up the term, speech control.
Right. And certainly like clear and present danger restrictions and things like that. Are in play, but I think the interest. So this is all. I feel like we've given the perspective that the government and social media haven't really been interacting. They definitely have. There have been meetings where Facebook and its like upper management or what have you have gone and sat with like the government councils on this. But it's pretty similar to what the New York Times saw, which is just like, we don't really know where we stand on this. I think YouTube has been big in those meetings as well. I'll try to find those articles so we can link them in the description to this podcast. But I think we're reaching a point where there like truly needs to be a head of like essentially there needs to be the really important internet people who understand what's at stake and how to actually curtail the problems need to sit down and be like, some of this stuff has to get figured out, because you can only see it just continuing to pile on until at a point it has to become unmanageable, right?
Yeah, I think it's like I said, it's going to challenge.
I think it already has, and we haven't been doing very well. Right.
That's what I'm saying. Because I don't see how you would do well, because it's believing facts. It's believing facts, and I think more importantly, it's checking power at the door.
Sure.
Right? I mean, that's why some deniers or whatever of facts, they're where they want to be. They deny climate change, for example.
Right.
Well, why are they doing that? Well, is it because their base believes that? Well, that's not right. You know, you're not here to remain in power.
Right.
You're not here to get reelected. You're here to improve the country. So I think that's something where our elected officials need to sit down and make maybe not the best decisions for themselves, but the best decisions for the future, looking long term rather than short term. And I'm not sure where we are in that path.
Well, because it all starts at what the internet was originated for. Like how do you tear off the internet, right? So you can't, well, I won't say you can't. Should we be policing like eastsidestevie.tumblr.com the same way as we're policing Alex Jones and InfoWars on Twitter? Rest in peace, ASAP Yams.
I don't know what you just said.
But like, you know, do you know what I mean? Like, is my fake Instagram page, let's say I have one, I don't, but let's say I have a fake Instagram page. Should that be policed the same way that Donald Trump's Twitter page is policed? Should I be held to the same standard?
I think that it is, in terms like if and we've seen examples of people on Twitter saying they're going to commit an act of violence and they are arrested for it.
Sure. Rarely.
I think when it's brought to the attention, I mean, I don't know.
What was it was the YouTube comments of the Parkland shooter were brought to federal, I think it was brought up to FBI attention prior to the shooting, and they didn't do anything about it, you know? So it seems, it's rather hit and miss, you know? That's what I'm saying. It's like, it seems like it's being weighed differently if it comes from a private citizen, than when it comes from a public figure.
you brought up one example. You know, I just
to
think,
an extent, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen examples where it has. You know, I mean, one example doesn't mean anything in terms of
its context, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I think we've already learned, have we not, in terms of whatever you post on social media,
that'll come back forever.
Yep. I mean, look at Major League Baseball right now. They're dealing with that of, you know, racist tweets or anything. It doesn't matter if you were 14, which I think is probably unfair.
Sure.
In terms, or I think Bomani Jones of ESPN said it the best, is show the evidence of how you've evolved. You know, there's never a follow-up question,
right,
of how have you changed, not... Okay,
yeah,
changed.
Exactly. Yeah,
that's
don't
where
just
the interesting
give me a,
aspect is.
Don't give me a statement. Give me a quick sidebar. I would love to like have an interview with some of those people who can articulate, like, this is where I grew up. This is why I was saying those things at the time. Here's where I realized it was a problem.
But we are. So, yes, forward. We are policing the, you know, it matters.
We're policing. Yes.
And maybe that in turn will... There'll be an overcorrection because we are policing that, and then no one's going to want to be on there.
You know who's policing that stuff. It's not the government, or it's Twitter users. So, like, this sort of brings us back to Twitter's original point, which is, like, it's not our job to police who's saying bad things. It's journalists' jobs. Well, no, like, Twitter users and journalists aren't on staff for Twitter. Like, if you want those people to police your infrastructure, then...
It's a
put
yes and. I mean, we're in total philosophy mode right now, but if every single person had a Twitter and they were an active member, then yeah, it would work. Because what's a journalist? I remember I was talking to some students at a middle school, and they were asking me what a journalist was, and they were asking me a lot of questions. And I said, you're a journalist. You didn't know anything about me. You were asking questions about my background.
Now you know.
And
sure.
That's all that it is. So the people saying policing or retweeting or... There's kind of some journalism ethics, journalism integrity there, which is presenting something.
Right.
And then letting the masses decide
what is
right or wrong. It is raining outside.
Right.
Is that good or bad? You decide.
I think, yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, that's... The thing that needs to be stated very clearly then by these social media companies is this is a self-policed entity. And those things need to be taken really seriously then, if that's the case.
And Twitter's the only person who's really done that, only entity that's done that. Facebook and others have said, no, that's not the case.
Because there's of course the option to report somebody. But whether or not those things are taken seriously is up for debate. And also I'm curious to see, like... This is a question on a different topic, but do you think now, with all of the Alex Jones stuff that's happening, do you think now these institutions will be quicker to hand these decisions down? Because you look at the reporting on Alex Jones, and he's been being reported with community violations for the last, like, however long he's been on YouTube.
In theory, what we've basically been having this entire conversation, in theory, in reality... It's impossible to police everyone on Twitter. I mean, is it impossible? I mean, you just hire...
You would think it wouldn't be impossible to police the biggest of the big, though, right? That's where my head always goes to financial bottom line.
Well, to me, that's where it comes in. We look at, you know, as I mentioned, the First and Second Amendment. We'll look at the Second. We have these new guns that are being made at
3D printing guns. Yeah.
And the government's saying, no, you have to have a serial number or metal on it to... That's right. A federal law. Well, the same thing, if manufacturers make guns with a certain amount of standard, if you can't do that, then you can't make guns. Twitter, if you can't police, if your product can't be safe, then you can't have a product.
Sure.
It's simple as that. Where, I mean, I've had an example where I came here, I changed my Twitter handle from Mike B. Bonner to Mike B. Bonner SCT. Someone took my @MikeBBonner Twitter handle and basically kept my same bio.
Right.
And totally just made it like, you know, an adult oriented Twitter handle.
Right.
I went to Twitter and said, hey, look, this person's like, you know, imitating me.
Right.
And it's not, I'm like a professional journalist. This is my account is really.
Right.
Directly tied to me. This can't be happening. And they found that there wasn't enough tie. Because I needed to, I think, provide some information to them. And I was like, I'm not providing you with like my ID and like
right.
stuff to prove who I am.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then they said, well, then if you don't want to provide, I think it was like your license, then I can't. No.
What? Your license is not tied to Twitter.
I am not like, yeah, I'm not with all the hacks that have happened.
Give
Twitter,
me your
I'm sorry.
Social security number. And your
it was something crazy like that. And they were like, no, since you, there's not enough evidence to show this, when it was clearly enough evidence. I didn't even notice. Someone brought it to my attention, one of my former followers.
Right.
So if they can kind of see it, anyone can really see it except Twitter.
Right.
So there definitely needs to be some policing in there. And if you can't do it, then your product isn't.
It's not really. It's not that it's not worth anything. It's just not sustainable at the end of the day, right? Because, well, but yeah, we always come back to this point, which is even let's say hypothetically it's deemed that like Twitter can't scale this to the next level it has to scale, which is providing more safety, providing essentially a place where like misinformation can't be spread that changes the landscape of the American thinking to a certain extent. Will people leave the platform? They haven't left before. Like, does anyone ever leave social media platforms?
But MySpace, even though it still has a lot of people, but not as much as it had.
But is MySpace old enough to where it just got taken out by a better interface, right?
I'm sitting here struggling. I think you're right. It's a good question, but I don't know if we know.
That's true.
I think that you're right. Like right now, 2018, if you told me, is Facebook going to disappear? I would have to say no. But the same thing, for the same reasons that if somebody said in 1970 that in 40 years, even, you can even go to the 80s, even then, we could go 90s.
Right.
If you said Ford is not going to make cars anymore, just trucks and SUVs, someone would be like, you're insane.
Right.
I think as UMass Dartmouth's chancellor said at one of his, I heard him talk, he said, in the 90s, if you said the biggest, most powerful companies in the world, or some of the most powerful companies in the world, what we're talking about, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, they're going to be giants. They're going to be worth more than the Detroit Big Three, the car manufacturers, and they're not going to make anything.
Yeah, people wouldn't have believed that.
They're not going to. You're going to love this thing. It's going to be Netflix. It's going to be huge, and you're not going to. They don't make anything, but they're going to be billionaires. People will be like, no. So because of that, I would say I don't know what the future holds. But you're right. I can't. I don't know how Facebook would dissolve, but.
It is interesting to think about like the next steps of social media, right? Like, what does that look like? So it always seems like there's a point that's hit where like people decide enough is enough. We're going to, by use of our dollar or our interaction, decide that this is no longer the thing we do. That was the case with MySpace. People just stop using the interface. It's interesting to sort of think long term and hypothesize about what that could possibly be, especially in the modernity where we're like, well, maybe this is it, like every other week.
But that's the other question I think that would be the ultimate thing, is if it was capitalistic in the sense of consumers, because you're paying, we're not paying for any of these services, specifically Instagram.
Sure.
So that's, I think if there was a value attached to it,
that's
I think
true
it would
too.
Matter.
Yeah, I didn't think
but
about
the
that.
Fact that like where it doesn't matter. I can create an account and move on, and
it's all
I use it or not.
Right. It's all like, yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. We always reach this point, but it's like we don't really know.
If I had to pay for Twitter, I think it would, or any of those sites, it would vastly change things because.
I just wouldn't use it.
Yeah, people wouldn't use it.
Yeah.
And what value would you be providing me? But since it's free, it really kind of creates its own.
It's interesting to think that, it's just really interesting to think that these free interfaces are being Alex Jones's profits. At the end of the day, you can probably say with almost certainty that he will be affected by the fact that these free websites no longer allow him to put his content on them, which is kind of nuts the way that business works.
And I think that's a perfect segue into
what
part
we're gonna talk about next week
is kind of the business aspect of these social media aspects. So hopefully you've enjoyed part one and two. Part three next week, we're excited for it.
It's going to be prototypical Mike Bonner, Montana Samuels hypothesizing. So if you've listened to the bubble for this long, I'm sure you'll like it. If you're new to it, we'll see.
We'll see. That's what we'll bring here. We may not like it, but we'll see.
For Mike Bonner, I am Montana Samuels, and we hope you'll have us back.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.